Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will be first broadcast on Wednesday, December 6, 2023, on 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprouts. You can also check out my Facebook page and Instagram at FranStorchND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. All right, let's check in with a bunch of stuff. I just want to really emphasize that I have been very happily getting a fair bit of exercise. I've been walking. I ran the Manchester Road Race. It took a little bit to recover from that, but I did. I haven't run since. I may start running a 5K a month. I might start doing that. You know, it might be a walk run, but I might start doing that. But I have only been in that realm. I've only been walking since then. I've also been doing yoga, and I have also been on my bike, both on the indoor trainer as well as outdoors. Outdoors has been dicey because the weather's been, it's been getting really cold, and it's that time when you start to move indoors if you're so inclined. There are a lot of people who are not inclined to ride their bikes indoors. Ron is not one of those. He is teaching very many spin classes right now. I have not been going to spin classes because it's easier for me to ride on my trainer at home. The time of day that the spin classes occur doesn't really work with my schedule, and I don't get enough sleep. And I've found that getting 8 to 9 hours of sleep is very, very important to my health. And I recommend that for you too. Find out the sweet spot for sleep for you. Getting sleep. My friend Beth said to me, sleep can turn into anything. Sleep turns into creativity. Sleep turns into productivity. Sleep turns into you creating wonderful things in your life. It's really important to do. So finding the amount of sleep that works for you is important. And I have something to say about sleep as well. One of the things I read that was a great reminder is about the hormone melatonin. Everybody's like, should I take melatonin? The answer is maybe. Melatonin will only be helpful for you for sleep if you are melatonin insufficient. How do you know if you're melatonin insufficient? If you take melatonin, it helps you to get a good night's sleep and you don't have weird dreams. If you take melatonin and you get strange dreams from it, there's an interplay between melatonin and serotonin. And if you have increased serotonin, you're going to get strange dreams. They could be upsetting dreams. They could be just very vivid dreams. But if you're getting that and you took melatonin, you're probably melatonin sufficient. You've got too much melatonin on board. So if you're going to try taking melatonin to help you with your sleep, please consider that it's only going to be good for you if you are melatonin insufficient. If you get those weird dreams, it's probably not the right thing for you. Now, it is normal for us to make melatonin throughout the course of the day. Our melatonin has an inverse relationship to our cortisol. How interesting is that? So your cortisol, which is your fight or flight hormone, it's a hormone that comes from your adrenal glands. It runs around your body and it breaks down tissue so that it turns it into sugar so you can run away from the bear or do whatever it is you need to do. Do your radio naturopath or pat Ron on the head or do your, you know, sit and see your patients. Whatever it is you're going to get done on a given day, you put sugar into your blood so you have the energy to do it. That's what cortisol's job is.
Patted me on the head.
I did. It's very cute. So anyway, I needed cortisol to do that. I needed it because I needed energy.
Did it help?
There was glucose involved in me patting you on the head. How funny is that?
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, my point is that cortisol peaks in the morning. It's cortisol is at its highest level in the morning, which is why some people don't feel like eating a super lot in the morning and feel like being very productive in the morning. Your cortisol, you would think you'd have ups and downs in cortisol throughout the day, but that's actually not normal. What's normal is to peak in your cortisol and to have a gradual drop in your cortisol until your cortisol is low enough in the evening between 9 o'clock and midnight so that you can fall asleep. Cortisol starts to rise at midnight. So if you stay up past midnight, you're going to be awake during that cortisol rise. The later you try to go to sleep, the harder it is to get to sleep. So the earlier you try to get to sleep, the easier it is, unless it's too early and your cortisol is too high. As I said, there's an inverse relationship between cortisol and melatonin. So melatonin helps you to feel sleepy, which is why people take it to help them with their sleep. So your melatonin is made in your pineal gland. Pineal gland, pointing to, if you're watching me on Facebook or Instagram, you can see that I'm pointing to between my eyebrows. So my pineal gland is behind where I'm putting my finger. It's not way up here at the third eye. It's a little bit lower, sort of behind your nose, at the top of your nose. Anyway, your pineal gland is responsible for making melatonin. And melatonin is... it helps you to feel sleepy, and it peaks at around 9, 10 o'clock at night. So we had a saying in Newfoundland, and I think this is a saying other places in the world too, but the saying was, every hour before midnight counts as two. And I find that that is true for me, that if I feel the best if I go to sleep somewhere in the 10 o'clock hour. If I'm tired enough and I can fall asleep in the 9 o'clock hour, that's fine. Usually if I'm falling asleep between 8 and 9 o'clock at night, it's because I took a supplement that jazzed up my GABA too much, my gamma-aminobutyric acid, which is a calming neurotransmitter. And things like taurine and ashwagandha and L-theanine and even some nerving herbs can increase your GABA. And if I increase my GABA too much, I get too sleepy and groggy and wake up groggy the next morning. And I discovered I was taking too much ashwagandha and I had to stop. So I'll get to that in a minute. Now, in terms of the melatonin, the interesting thing about melatonin is melatonin bottoms out in the morning so that you can wake up. And it gradually increases throughout the day, and then it peaks between like 9, 10 o'clock and midnight. And if you can fall asleep when melatonin is peaking, you're going to get your best night's sleep. If you go to sleep after melatonin has peaked, then you're not going to feel as good in the morning. You're not going to sleep as well. So that's why it's a good idea to get into bed when your melatonin is peaking, somewhere between 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock, depending on who you are. If you're a person who you feel fabulous if you go to bed at 8 and you wake up at 6, that's great. I mean, everybody has a slightly different circadian cycle. In fact, there are 3 different circadian cycle types. The most common type is what I am. I feel good waking up somewhere between 7 and 9 a.m., depending on the day, depending how tired I am, and going to sleep between 10 and 11 p.m. That's the most common circadian type. If that's you and you have to get up earlier than that, you probably feel tired a lot of the time. The second most common type is the early bird. So that's the person who feels fabulous when they get up in the morning. They can get up between 5 and 7 a.m. and go to sleep at maybe between 8 and 9 p.m. or 8 to 10 p.m. at latest. And they feel very productive in the morning. And they feel sleepy between 8 and 10 and have to go to sleep somewhere between there. And then the least common type, and there are people out there who are this type, but they are the night owls. So the night owl is going to be someone who feels the best going to sleep sometime after midnight and sleeping in, waking up, 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, maybe later. And our friend Kite is like that. That's a tough place to be. So as you can imagine, people who work who work night shift, most people are not set up to work night shift. If you're a night owl, you might be, but if you are not a night owl, chances are you're not a night owl, because I said the highest proportion of people are either that 7 to 8 a.m. to 10 to 11 a.m. circadian type, followed by the early birds. So the fewest types of people, the fewest circadian rhythm is the night owl. So most people are not night owls, which means that most people don't do well with night shift. And because they're awake when their melatonin is highest and their cortisol is lowest. It's really bad. And that can bring them to all kinds of unfortunate situations. So my advice to you is if you cannot work swing shift, or if you cannot work, well, swing shift, but as well as night shift, if you cannot do that, that's better for you, unless you're a night owl. And if you can make a pact with yourself to try to get in bed somewhere, depending on your circadian type, somewhere between 8 and 10 p.m., and get to sleep, that every hour before midnight counts as two. The reason it's that way, it's not just a saying. It's because of the relationship between melatonin and cortisol. You want to get into bed when your cortisol is lowest and your melatonin is highest, and you'll get the best night's sleep. So, and only take melatonin as a sleep aid if you are demonstrably melatonin insufficient, and you can take a blood test for melatonin, but a better way to do it is to try to take melatonin. If you get weird dreams and you feel groggy in the morning, it's not for you, and I wouldn't recommend taking it. So there you go. So that's kind of an interesting thing. All right. And so the next thing I wanted to talk about, remember I've been dealing with Lyme and autonomic stuff. My autonomic stuff is doing pretty well. I do have to make sure that I stay hydrated. Because if I stay hydrated, I keep my blood volume up, which means I'm going to get more circulation to my brain. I'm going to be less likely to feel dizzy. I really do think that I had Lyme disease this summer, and that is why I was having headaches and migraine-like symptoms, because I haven't been having any of that. I haven't been having any headaches, no migraine symptoms, no nausea, all these weird symptoms I was having during the summer. And I haven't, as I said, I haven't been shaking. I think I had one mild episode of shaking, a shaking head, and it was a couple nights after the Manchester Road Race, because I had just been exercising so much. And my shaking is related to inflammation. So I probably had too much inflammation because I had ridden my bike 22 miles the day after I ran the Manchester Road Race. So it was probably a little bit too much. So I haven't been back-to-back doing that level of exercise in a long time. So I've been better, and I've been watching my hydration, and I don't seem to have to do electrolytes all the time. I definitely do electrolytes when I'm on the bike, but I don't have to do them all the time, although they do help. And the other thing that I have noticed is that my orthopedics are doing really, really well. And I think the reason I'm doing really well with the orthopedics is because I'm very, very consistently taking collagen along with anti-inflammatories. By anti-inflammatories, I do not mean NSAIDs. Remember that NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, like ibuprofen, like naproxen, meloxicam, name your NSAID, over the long term, they tend to block cyclooxygenase, which is an inflammatory system in your blood, in your body, and they tend to upregulate lipoxygenase, which is an inflammatory another inflammatory cycle. And when you upregulate lipoxygenase, you get inflammation, and you can get inflammation in joints. So if you overdo ibuprofen and other NSAIDs and other non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, you can get increased joint degeneration. So I stay away from those. I was using naproxen on days when I had a lot of pain, when I was having my femoral nerve pain. I'm not having nerve pain anymore, so I don't use it at all. So when I say anti-inflammatories, what I'm taking to reduce inflammation is fish oil, medium chain triglycerides, and curcumin. And I guess you would say resveratrol has some anti-inflammatory benefits too. It's more of an antioxidant, but I'm taking that as well. And I'm taking a special collagen supplement that also has an extract of Chinese skullcap in it. So I have nice anti-inflammatories that are not breaking down my collagen, my joints. And I'm also taking collagen, which is helping to rebuild my joints. Also, my protein shake of choice is bone broth protein. And we're having soups with bone broth as a base. So I'm getting a decent amount of collagen. So I'm hoping it's making my hair look nice. If you're watching on Facebook Live or Instagram, you can see my hair. It's okay. I mean, it's pretty good for a 60-year-old lady, right? And
60?
Yeah. Big 60.
Yikes.
I think the last time I made a show was before I turned 60. So now I'm a 60-year-old lady. Oh my goodness, I'm in my 7th decade. How did that even happen? So the collagen, I think it helps my skin, it helps my hair, and it's definitely helping my joints, because I was really at the point where I was wondering if I was going to have knee surgery, and I was wondering if I was going to have back surgery. My back, I have virtually no back pain, and my knee is a little tricky, but it's not bad. And I am able to ride my bike, I'm able to do yoga, and I am able to walk, and I was able to run the Manchester Road Race. I do throw a little KT tape on it to help with extra support. I'm also putting some magnesium on it, magnesium oil, as well as a nice herbal salve that has arnica and ginger and actually has some cardamom in it and other anti-inflammatory herbs. So I'm doing that as well. And doing a lot of yoga, doing both stretchy yoga as well as yin yoga. And I love my yin yoga. My yin and restorative yoga is fantastic. So I'm very happy with that. And then I treated myself for Lyme disease, and I'm monitoring myself to make sure I'm not getting any Lyme symptoms back. And if I do, I have stuff to take. I have herbs to take. So I went to the Lyme Bites conference, and I already did one episode where I talked about some of the things that I learned, and it was such a rich conference, had so much information in it, and I wasn't able to do it all in one show. So I'm going to do another show today where we talk about what I learned at the Lyme Bites conference. We saw Dr. Burruscano there, Dr. Joseph Burruscano, who has been treating Lyme holistically for many years. And he talked to, he was on Zoom, so he was Zoomed in, so I'm not sure where he's living. He was on Long Island. I don't know if he's still there. But anyway, I got to see Dr. Burruscano speak. One of the things he talked about was tick-borne relapsing fever, and I'm wondering if that's what I have, because I remember when I was bitten by a tick, it was not a small tick. It was a larger dog tick, and you can get tick-borne relapsing fever from larger ticks. So he said a tick-borne relapsing fever, because my symptoms came and went, I would have some days where I felt just fine, and then some days where all of a sudden I felt headachy and shaky and sick and nauseous, and it came and went until it was gone. And so I'm wondering if that's what I had. It mimics Lyme disease. It's surprisingly common, so it's quite possible that that's what I had. And it's a different species that it's not... Borrelia burgdorferi, it's a different species of Borrelia. Lyme hits many systems. It's the musculoskeletal system. It's the neurological system. It hits any symptom, any system at all, really. And certainly your heart and your respiratory, your cardiovascular system. And the other thing is that Lyme has migratory neuropathy, which means that you might have nerve pain in your back that goes away and then travels to your leg and then travels somewhere else. It migrates because the spirochetes cycle in terms of their lifespan, and they cycle as far as where they set up in your body. Classically, Lyme has a 4-week cycle with Borrelia burgdorferi. The cycle can be shorter with TBRF, with the tick-borne relapsing fever, which is what I found. It was not 4 weeks. It was, you know, I'd have a few good days and a few bad days and a few good days and a few bad days. So I'm wondering if I had TBRF. When somebody has Bartonella, which is what we think of as cat scratch disease, it can definitely be tick transmitted. Somebody has a lot of irritability, and they have a general psychiatric dysfunction. You want to be thinking about Bartonella. Bartonella can also hit the eyes. So if somebody's having some of these symptoms and they have problems with their eyes, if you get somebody in this region and they come up with all of a sudden they have uveitis or retinitis, think about Bartonella. Think about testing them for Bartonella. It can mess up the arteries in the eyes. It can cause blood clots and thrombosis in the eyes. There's a test called FISH, and FISH, it's a immunofluorescence test that you test. I'm not sure what FISH stands for, but you use the FISH test earlier, late in the illness, or if the person is immunosuppressed. Otherwise, you can use the immunoblot, which is just when you do a blood test with where you're testing antibodies. No test is 100% effective, so you have to diagnose tick-borne illness clinically. If you're watching me on Facebook Live or on Instagram, you can see that I talk with my... I guess Jewish people talk with their hands too, do they?
Yeah, I would say.
Okay. All right, so Babesia. Babesiosis is the most common Lyme co-infection. Mm. So test your patients for Babesia, or ask your doc to test you for Babesia if you also have Lyme disease. I always test for it because I see it. Ron had it.
That's what I had the last time.
You had Babesia and Lyme. You had both.
And I felt horrible.
Felt horrible, right.
Yeah, and somebody else just tested for that, positive for that.
Oh,
felt
no.
Yeah.
A friend of yours?
Yeah.
Or somebody,
yeah, like within the last month, I talked to somebody who
it's
said
really
they had
common.
Babesia.
Ticks are plentiful. They're a rich source of infection. They're just so fantastic.
Yeah. It was before the big freeze, so it was...
Right.
You know,
so we've had some freezes, which is really nice. We've had some overnights where we've been down in the 20s. I actually saw some ice on Mansfield Hollow Lake. I don't know if it's still there.
No.
And we're going to see 50s later this week, so... We're not going to hold on to any ice. It was very sad last year. I mean, it was a real sign of climate change in that, you know, one of the things I celebrate is when I see the first ice fisherman out on Mansfield Hollow Lake, because then it's like, yep, it's winter. And last year, I don't know if I saw any. If I saw it, it was once, and it wasn't for very long, but there was no appreciable ice on Mansfield Hollow Lake, or it was very little. There might have been a week or so where there was, but usually it freezes, and then it's like that for a couple months, and the ice fishers are out there drinking their beer and
whatever
and
it is,
sitting in their huts, and yeah, so
avoiding contact at home.
That too, you know, my wife said to me, "It's fishing or me," and I'm sure going to miss her.
But you're
not into fishing, are you?
No.
All right. Okay. So there is a company called Vibrant America, which does technology in the lab space, and they do the kind of testing that they do is supposed to be very very sensitive. The ELISA test, which is commonly done for Lyme disease, only has about 50% sensitivity. So if you're getting a Lyme screen, that's why I don't even bother with it. I do the Western blot. The Western blot is sensitive but not specific. So if you have antibodies that show up in a Lyme Western blot test, which is an IgM and IgG antibody test for Lyme disease, if you show antibodies there, it means you have something. It may mean you have Lyme disease, and in a lot of times it probably does, but it's not specific, which means that they're measuring the lengths of antibodies and their charge in kilodaltons. The thing is, the different antibody lengths and the antibodies are... If they show up as positive, it means you have something. They're responding to something, but they may not be responding to Lyme disease. So, for example, the IgG, the 41 kilodalton band, cross-reacts with other things. I believe it cross-reacts with Epstein-Barr virus. But if you have a 41 kilodalton band, it may or may not mean you have Lyme disease. And if only 41 comes up and the person doesn't particularly have symptoms, I may not treat them for Lyme disease. However, if they have a bunch of antibodies come up and they have symptoms, I will treat them. Also, if they have symptoms, I don't care what the antibodies say, I will treat them, or I will volunteer to treat them. Whether they want to be treated is another question. But Lyme is a clinical diagnosis. You heard that here. You will hear it from Dr. Moorcroft. You will hear it from Dr. Burscano. You will hear it from Dr. Hinchy. You will hear it from anybody who treats Lyme disease regularly. Lyme is a clinical diagnosis. The lab tests are not as important as what your symptoms are. This is my hand. You're getting to see a lot of it today. And yes, I like to dance, and I like to, anyway. Okay. So, anyway, so the vibrant wellness test, they do a protein microarray with immunochip technologies. Very interesting. They also offer blood spot testing. But if you want to do total immune globulins, you have to do a blood draw. All right. Now, my buddy, Dr. Hinchey, who I have to do a big shout out to, Mariah Hinchey, she practices in Hebron, and she put together this conference, and she has devoted herself to helping people with Lyme disease. And like a lot of us, now you know that I did not come to naturopathic medicine because I was ill. I came to naturopathic medicine because it was what I wanted to do. I'm very fortunate that I didn't have. Some people came to naturopathic medicine because they had some kind of a serious illness. They went to a naturopathic physician, and the naturopathic physician helped them. And so they're like, all right, that's what I want to do. That's not how I came to it. I came to it because, number one, I wanted to be a doctor. Number two, I wanted to move out west, and I wasn't sure why. And number three, when I found the profession, I just found the profession at a health fair, and I said, yep, that's what I want to do. This is all the things I want to do. I want to help people. I want to use my brain. I want to use science. I want to have something that's interesting and varied. And I want to study out west. So it checked all the boxes, and it became what I did. And when I left, my boss at the time, Carl Bost, he said to me, "You're very fortunate, Fran, because you have found a profession that really fits who you are." And I think he's right. I think that's true. Don't you think that's true? There are aspects of the profession that are difficult because, seeing a lot of patients, dealing with a lot of people, having to do the charting, there's a lot of work involved, and there's a lot of work that isn't just naturopathic medicine involved. There's a lot of organization, and there's a lot of there's purchasing, and there's taxes, and there's all kinds of things that you didn't even think about. And then there's accounting, but that's part of running a business. So what are you going to do? So anyway, so big shout out to Dr. Hinchey for putting this all together. She came to treating Lyme disease because she had it, and then she studied it. And so one of the things that a smart naturopathic physician does is if you get a condition, you use yourself as a test subject, and you figure out what works, which is what I do whenever I get anything, which is why you hear me talking about. I'm not talking about my condition because I want you to know about my condition because I'm vain. That's not why. I'm telling you because this happened to me. This is what I did, and maybe it'll help you too. So, like, if you are looking at the possibility of surgery, for example, for discs in your back or discs or joints, you may want to try a trial of collagen and natural anti-inflammatories before you do that. Because it helped me, and I'm not interested in having surgery at this time. It's better to not have surgery. Surgery is invasive. You have to deal with anesthetic. You have to recover from the surgery. And once you cut into somebody, you don't 100% know how the healing is going to go. Now, if you have a very good surgeon, chances are things are going to be great. But you don't always know. It's better not to get surgery. I'm just putting that out there. So if you cannot get surgery, I'm back to riding my bike and yoga and walking and even running sometimes, and I'm okay. So here's what Dr. Hinchey has. It says Dr. Hinchey had chronic Lyme disease, and she treated herself and got better, and then she went and studied with Dr. Moorcroft and Dr. Burascano and probably Dr. Horowitz, and she learned as much as she can, so she focuses on treating tick-borne illness. So I'm very proud of her, and I'm proud to call her a friend, and really thrilled that she does these conferences, and she teaches me a lot, and she has you can follow her on Instagram because you'll get a lot of tips on helping yourself with tick-borne illness. All right, so what she said at the conference was that the person probably has immune dysfunction if they're not healing at an expected rate. Like after a couple of months, you want to see the person getting better. Lyme will persist. If the host immunity is working for Lyme instead of for the host, very, very wise words. There's a big old cytokine cascade, which means that they're kicking out a lot of inflammatory compounds. So to help a person with tick-borne illness, you want to help to normalize their immunity make their body inhospitable for the infection. You're dealing with an old-timey naturopathic concept, which is you're helping the terrain. You're making the terrain healthy and inhospitable for infection. And you want to heal the body. So if there's stuff wrong with the body, you want to help heal that. So remember that antibiotics do not completely eradicate the infection. I'm banging on the couch.
I feel that.
Yeah. Mm. So when you take antibiotics, don't expect them to completely clear your infection. What you're doing is you're giving your body a leg up by throwing microbes at the infection so that your body can do the rest. Remember we said we're doing that Western blot and that ELISA and all that stuff? You know why we're doing that? Because we're checking the body's response to the tick-borne illness. So the body is responding to the tick-borne illness. So guess what? The body is capable of fighting the tick-borne illness. Your body's immune system is supposed to work against the tick-borne illness. So when you take too much antibiotic, you disrupt your immunity in a number of ways. One of the ways is that you mess up your microbiome, especially your gut microbiome. So you're messing up the microflora, the bacteria and viruses and fungal elements that live in your digestive system. You're disrupting those, and those are the largest part of your immune system. There are buggies that normally live in your gut that will eat Lyme for you. And if you take too much antibiotic, you will kill them. All right. When you take antibiotics, you increase your gut permeability.
Of course.
So your gut permeability, because you're creating inflammation and because you're letting bad guys overgrow like yeasts and unfriendly bacteria. So they're going to create inflammation and you're going to create openings in your digestive system. So you're going to be absorbing compounds that you're not supposed to. You also can create persister cells. So what that means is that there are forms of especially Lyme disease that are impermeable to antibiotics. So Lyme has basically three forms. It has the spirochete form, which can be killed by antibiotics. Doxycycline, amoxicillin, and cephalosporins will go after spirochetes. They have a harder time going after the L form. Doxycycline will kill the L form. Amoxicillin, not so much. And then there's the cyst form, where it forms a little cyst, and then you have to go after it with antifungals. But if you take too much antibiotics, the spirochetes are very smart. They'll be like, oh, you're sending antibiotics my way. I'm going to hide. It'll do two main things. One of them is it will insist, and the other, encyst, E-N-C-Y-S-T. And the other thing it will do is create biofilm. Biofilm is a protein that it makes. So it's like in Jewish, we have an eruv. An eruv is an area where you live that if you stay inside it, you can travel inside of it. It's like a home, a multi-family home where you can stay inside during Shabbat. So the biofilm is like an eruv for the spirochetes to live. And it protects them from the outside world. What?
I'm laughing at your descriptions.
Yeah. Anyway, so biofilms can be impervious to antibiotics. They are not impervious to enzymes. So you can do things like lumbrokinase and natokinase to help to break them down. Lumbrokinase is earthworm enzyme.
Ooh.
Yeah. And natokinase is soy enzyme. And I take natokinase for other reasons. Natokinase is a great anti-inflammatory. It's helpful for blood pressure and cholesterol. So I'm taking that. I take that every day. I took that to help get rid of my post-vaccine stuff. Anyway, so Lyme causes immune dysregulation. It causes lots of inflammation. It increases inflammatory cytokines. Lyme creates enzymes that break down collagen. So I had a conversation with Mariah one day. I said, listen, you know, collagen is super popular right now. What do you think about people taking collagen who have Lyme disease? She said she thinks it's a good thing because you're overwhelming the body with collagen. And she thought that if you have excess collagen getting in, the spirochetes are going to go after the collagen that you're eating because it's more readily available than your own collagen. And a lot of the collagen is going to go towards rebuilding tissue. So she thinks it's just fine to take collagen. And I demonstrated that because I started taking collagen and I got better. And so taking collagen is something you can do when you have Lyme disease because you're going to provide a food source for the spirochetes so they don't go after your joints, and you will help to rebuild your tissue. Yeah, right?
That's interesting.
Right? I had a very specific conversation with Mariah at the CNPA conference, and we talked this over, and that was her opinion.
That makes a lot of sense.
I know, right? And the thing is, I am an N of one, but it worked. I mean, I took one of the things I did to treat myself was to take collagen, and I'm better. So clearly it worked. Lyme elevates galectin 3, which is this. It's an inflammatory compound, and galectin 3 goes around and damages a lot of tissues. Lyme also can cause endothelial damage. The endothelium is. You know what endothelium is?
No.
Okay. Endothelium
You should explain, though. It's your show.
So epithelium is the linings and coverings of all kinds of tissues. So you have epithelium. Your skin is covered in epithelium. Anything that communicates with the outside world is covered in epithelium. It's just a type of cell that communicates with the outside world. So there's epithelium on your skin, in your respiratory tract and in your digestive tract, all covered with epithelium. Endothelium is what's on it's very similar, but it's on the inside of your blood vessels. And Lyme spirochetes go after endothelium. Arr! So it's so messed. Lyme can cause increased intestinal toxicity, once again, because it messes up your microbiome, and it can go after the collagen. Goes after collagen. Where do you have collagen?
In your joints?
Everywhere. Right. So that's why Lyme is so horribly multi-system. I already said that Lyme forms biofilms. And, of course, you can have organ and system impairment, and it can hit anything. Because why? It eats collagen. Where's collagen? Every frickin' where. All right. So one of the things that...
You're almost on a rant.
I'm on a rant. I know. Isn't that crazy? Here, keep an eye on the time for me. All right.
I got time. Good. Got your time right there.
All right. This spike protein. So remember spike protein? That's from frickin' COVID. So the spike protein is on the surface of the COVID-19 virus. And spike protein ignites the same inflammatory cascade as Lyme disease, whether by vaccination or infection. So if you have chronic Lyme and you get vaccinated, you could have an increased response to the vaccine. And that may be one of the things that happened to me. I have some level of chronic Lyme that needed to be addressed, and that's why I reacted. So if you have a really bad reaction to the vaccine, it might be a good idea to get checked for tick-borne illness. Or if you have a really bad reaction to COVID, the same inflammatory cascade is affected. And so I kind of co-treated myself for long COVID as well as Lyme disease. I mean, some of the things I'm taking are for both. And so that's kind of interesting.
And you have gotten better since you went on that track.
Yeah, I know, right?
Definitely. There's been a solid improvement.
Yeah. Because I treated myself for both Lyme and post-COVID. I'm still taking some post-COVID stuff. Like I'm still taking anti-inflammatories. I'm taking resveratrol. I'm taking curcumin. I'm taking black cumin seed oil. I think black cumin seed oil is good for a lot of things. It's good for blood pressure. It's great anti-inflammatory. So I'm taking that. I'm not taking the Lyme. I'm not taking Lyme antimicrobials anymore because I don't think I need them at this point. So Lyme spirochetes produce hyaluronidase. So again, and hyaluronidase breaks down hyaluronic acid. So if you want to inhibit hyaluronidase, you want to slow the breakdown. So hyaluronic acid is in it's in your skin, it's in your joints. So that's another reason you get joint pain, and it's gonna dry you out. So you have hyaluronic acid. The big places are your joints and in your skin, but it's gonna be in any epithelial tissue as well. So that's gonna be your digestive system and your respiratory system all over the place, and your endothelium as well. So echinacea and ashwagandha inhibit hyaluronidase. So one reason to take ashwagandha. So I'm still taking some ashwagandha. I was taking ashwagandha, but so here's a sidetrack on ashwagandha. Ashwagandha is lovely, and if you're very stressed, it's a lovely thing to take. It inhibits hyaluronidase. I'm still taking some ashwagandha, but I was taking these lovely ashwagandha gummies at night. I got some in Florida, and I got them from the supermarket, so I don't think they were as potent as the ones that I got from my distributor. So I was taking ashwagandha gummies at night, and they're really nice gummies because they're gummies, and they were berry flavored. Yum, yum, yum. And I finished that bottle of ashwagandha gummies, and then I switched over to a high-end brand that had another 50 milligrams of ashwagandha in it. So I was taking 150 milligrams in my adrenal support supplement in the morning, and then I was taking another 200 milligrams in the evening. And then after a while, I found that I was falling asleep with this extreme fatigue at like 8:30 at night. And I said, that's probably something I'm taking. So I stopped taking the ashwagandha gummies. And they're these delicious gummies. They're apple cinnamon gummies. And they're really good. And they were really healthy. They didn't have sugar in them. They might have had a sugar alcohol in them. They were really tasty. And I stopped taking them and I felt better. So I'm still got ashwagandha on board, but I'm only taking 150 milligrams a day as part of an adrenal formula, which I take in the morning. So no more ashwagandha at night. If you are very stressed and you are having trouble sleeping and you have Lyme disease and you don't have to have Lyme disease to take ashwagandha, have it be helpful. But if you have joint pain, ashwagandha can be helpful for you. And you have to experiment with how much you take and when you take it. If you have trouble getting to sleep and you want to take ashwagandha at night, you can absolutely do that. If you take ashwagandha and you feel extra groggy and you crash out and you wake up groggy in the morning, you're probably taking too much. Again, I'm only taking 150 milligrams a day and in the morning or sometimes in the afternoon. And that's fine. And it doesn't knock me out. All right. So let's talk about some of the herbs, some of the things that Mariah likes to use to help people with Lyme disease. One of them, Japanese knotweed and Chinese skullcap, are NF-kappa beta inhibitors. And NF-kappa beta is it's a big inflammatory cascade that gets stimulated in both Lyme and COVID. And then there are IL-6 inhibitors, interleukin-6. And interleukin-1b both get stimulated with tick-borne illness. So Andrographis kudzu and Chinese skullcap inhibit interleukin-6. And then interleukin-1b is inhibited by cordyceps, Japanese knotweed, red sage, and Chinese skullcap. So if you do Japanese knotweed, now I don't know what Mariah would say about this, but I start with, if I'm going to do antimicrobials for Lyme, I've been starting with just Japanese knotweed and Chinese skullcap and a few other things because they go after so many things. They're antimicrobial. They will go after all of the forms of Lyme disease, and they will, and they get into your brain. And so, and they're anti-inflammatory. They do a lot of work to help you out, and they'll help to reduce the inflammation in your joints because they put Chinese skullcap in. There's a collagen supplement, and they put Chinese skullcap in it. So they're really, really helpful. Then there's IDO, indole-2,3-deoxygenase, which breaks down serotonin in the gut. IDO is broken down by, guess what? Chinese skullcap. So Chinese skullcap, boy, you can't lose with that stuff. Scutellaria bakelensis, or affectionately known as scoot bake. Quinolinic acid, or quin, which is an NMDA agonist. NMDA is N-methyldiaspartate agonist, which is an excitatory amino acid, excitatory amino acid, right? It overstimulates the brain. It can even cause seizures. Guess what calms it down? Chinese skullcap.
Of course. You seem to be on a roll here.
Yeah. Chinese skullcap protects your brain and it breaks down quinolinic acid. And then there's interleukin 8, which is calmed down by cordyceps, NAC, and I'm taking NAC. I was taking NAC before that to help me with my post-COVID stuff. NAC is brilliant. NAC, here's a side note on NAC. If you have somebody who has a habit, like a personal habit that they want to break. So nail biting or skin picking. Or I had a mom bring a kid in who was tearing up paper all the time. He just had this urge to tear things up. And we put him on I put him on NAC. And and his brother had something like that too. So I found an NAC drink, a watermelon flavored NAC drink with trace minerals in it. So because so the kid didn't have to pop a pill because it was a kid, you know, 10, 11 years old. And I found this drink that had NAC in it. And the other thing I loved about the drink, it's a powder. When you use powders and liquids, you can titrate the dose very finely. When you have a pill, you're stuck having to mess around with the pill, cutting it up, and you don't know how much you're doing. But when you have a powder or a liquid, you can do very finely titrated amounts. So you can do half a scoop, a quarter of a scoop, 3/8 of a scoop. You can do whatever you want and eyeball it, and you can change up the amount as needed. So NAC has anti-inflammatory properties to one of the interleukins that is stimulated in Lyme disease, and also it's a great neurological tonic, and it helps you to make glutathione, which is detoxifying antioxidant. Okay. Curcumin also calms interleukin 8, and so does, guess what? Chinese skullcap.
Of course.
Yeah. So the big three the big three herbs, I think, to help you with tick-borne illness, or especially Lyme disease, is going to be Japanese knotweed, Chinese skullcap, and ashwagandha. Because the Japanese knotweed and Chinese skullcap have many anti-inflammatory properties, cross the blood-brain barrier, and they go after many forms of the spirochete. And then ashwagandha is an anti-hyaluronidase, that's great. That's really good. So you're going to do well with those things. Then remember your galectin 3. When galectin 3 is elevated, it causes ongoing chronic inflammation. It causes autoimmunity, cytokines, increased cytokines, mast cell activation. So if you're getting hive-like symptoms, galectin 3 could be involved. It will cause adhesion of the pathogens. The microorganisms will stick to places in your body. And it will enhance biofilms to be formed. Promotes inflammation in the gastrointestinal system so that microorganisms can re-enter your circulation. Bad stuff. So you want to help. So that's why you want to help with micronutrients, digestion and absorption, support sleep, get rid of biotoxins and mold. So Mariah thinks that adaptogenics are really band-aids. They're not directly treating the cause, but they are helpful. So it doesn't mean don't use adaptogenics. So adaptogenic is an herb that helps a lot of systems. So those are going to be your herbs. Once again, ashwagandha, one of the things it is an adaptogenic. But remember, it also is an anti-hyaluronidase, so it's really important. But it is an adaptogenic. So is rhodiola. So is eleuthero. So is cordyceps. Maca is another one. These are all adaptogenics. There are many, many herbs that are considered to be adaptogenics. Devil's club is another one. And I could probably think of a lot more that are considered adaptogenics. To break down biofilms, you're looking at enzymes. So serrapeptase and natokinase can be helpful. So berberines and curcumin, which I didn't think about curcumin as being something that broke down biofilms, but I take it all the time for my various inflammatory issues. Curcumin is definitely something that's indicated post-COVID. Also, with Lyme disease, and it's going to help with breaking down biofilms. So it's going to open up, it's going to, you know, tear down the curtain so that the spirochetes are exposed and can be killed. Grapefruit seed extract can also break down biofilms, as can oregano oil. And oregano oil I tend to push when people have tick-borne illness. Oregano oil does a lot of good stuff. I mean, the carvacrol in oregano can kill spirochetes, and it's also antifungal, and it's generally antimicrobial. It's very broad spectrum, so it's a really good thing to take. And if you're getting messed up microflora, it can help with that too. Garlic, which I can't take, it's so unfortunate because garlic is so powerful. Garlic in high doses can go after spirochetes. And and okay, it can.
You just sent somebody a message. That
I
was
did?
Nice. Yeah. It's okay.
Okay. And garlic is.
Little Miss Italian hands here.
I think they're Jewish hands.
I think Jewish, too.
Garlic is antimicrobial. It's broad spectrum antimicrobial, including antispirochetal. And olive leaf helps to break down biofilms, too. And so does monolaurin. And monolaurin is extract of coconut, and it is also antispirochetal. So you want to help people with detox. Modified citrus pectin helps people to detoxify. One of the things modified citrus pectin does is calm galactin 3. So, and the other thing is modified citrus pectin will help to drag, like if you're trying to prevent a Herxheimer reaction, which is where you're going after the tick stuff with antimicrobials, and the microbes are dumping their toxins into your system, modified citrus pectin can help with that. Glutamine can help to heal the digestive system. Tryptophan can help you to make more serotonin to help your digestive system work better. You want to make sure that you have adequate zinc, vitamins A, D, and C, and also polyphenols. Polyphenols you're going to find in like green tea and, again, resveratrol and your anthocyanins and your berries. To support glutathione, which we talked about already, NAC, as I said, you can offer selenium. Alpha-lipoic acid can be helpful. And also eat your cruciferous vegetables. So I'm assuming that in our stir-fry tonight, there will be broccoli. There will be broccoli.
There's broccoli in the refrigerator,
right,
if that means anything.
Curcumin also helps to bolster curcumin. Amazing stuff.
Mm.
Helps to bolster glutathione and the sulforaphane. Sulforaphanes you're going to find in cruciferous vegetables as well as in your alliums, your garlic, onions, shallots, chives, etc. Things that methylate. So methylation, sulfation, acetylation, you're supporting all these detoxifying systems. And so you want to offer binders to help people to get rid of the Herxheimer reaction. So binders could be zeolite, it could be bentonite clay, and it could be charcoal, activated charcoal.
Okay.
And you could take Epsom salt baths. Make sure you drink lots of water. It's going to help all your organs do their work better. Infrared saunas. There was a guy there who had infrared saunas for sale at the conference, and that was real. Boy, sitting in an infrared sauna sometime, they're so nice. Oh, my goodness. You can do just deep breathing will help you because it calms your cortisol, so it'll help your immune system work better. You can do castor oil packs on your liver, which will help the liver to work better. You can do dry skin brushing. Dry skin brushing helps to stimulate the lymphatics to work better. You can do cryo contrast therapy, where you're doing alternating hot and cold baths. If you want to bind endotoxins, things that can help with that are going to be modified citrus pectin, chlorella, NAC, just micronutrients. So if you get taken, there are certain products, certain brands that have, there's micronutrients, there's trace minerals in all of their formulations. And if you take any one of those, so say you're taking a multi from that company or you're taking a mineral from that company, you're going to get your micronutrients. If you need to alkalize, you can take Alka-Seltzer Gold if you need to, and chlorella and minerals. And then NAC, Japanese knotweed and Chinese skullcap are all great anti-inflammatories. To manage Herxheimer reactions, as we said, so what you're doing is you want to bind lipopolysaccharides. Lipopolysaccharides are the compounds in the spirochetes that give you Herxheimer reactions. And so that's going to be things like sarsaparilla, cleavers, chlorella, modified citrus pectin, zeolite, and activated charcoal. So Dr. Horowitz, God bless him, Richard Horowitz over in Hyde Park, New York, if he's still in Hyde Park, New York, I'm not sure. Anyway, so he has a formula for Herx's. 1,500 grams of liposomal, or 1,500 milligrams of liposomal glutathione, the juice of one lemon, 2 Alka-Seltzer Gold, and 8 ounces of water. So Mariah Here's her seven most used antiborrelials that'll kill Lyme spirochetes. They are Japanese knotweed, cat's claw, Chinese skullcap, surprise, surprise, sweet Annie, also known as Artemisia annua, which is, by the way, a great, and it's a vermifuge. It kills, it'll kill a lot of stuff, but it will kill Lyme disease, and it's kills worms. It's an antiparasitic. And she also uses Cryptolepis, Hotunia, and black walnut. For Babesia, you want to check the person's arginine levels, and if low, offer them arginine, or you can also offer them L-citrulline, which will raise arginine. And licorice, sweet Annie, and Chinese skullcap will go after Babesia. So the spleen has to make interferon gamma, and the body has to produce nitric oxide and increases interleukin 12 and regulates IL-10. So the spleen helps with all that. So Chinese skullcap, Japanese knotweed, and ashwagandha, as I said, big three as far as I'm concerned. And if the person also has babesiosis, consider using sweet Annie and red sage, Salvia militariacea. So for Babesia, you're looking at Cryptolepis, Alcornea, Sitta acuta, Biden's pilosa, and Artemisia species. And then when you have Lyme and Babesia together, we talked about a lot of these things. Modified citrus pectin, ashwagandha, red sage, Chinese skullcap, Japanese knotweed, cat's claw, teasel, and black walnut. So you can make tinctures with all of these in it. Or if the person has to, they may have to take them separately depending on how they work. She, dietarily, she's all about no dairy, no sugar, no gluten. And she also will offer white blood cell micronutrient testing. She likes to do food intolerance testing for IgA and maybe IgG, both IgG and IgA food allergies, because it doesn't make sense to eat a food that's giving you more inflammation. And she will often not treat antimicrobially until like the third visit. She doesn't give antimicrobials until like six to eight weeks in, and before that she wants the person to work on their diet and digestion and detoxification, because if you give somebody who's already sick and toxic antimicrobials, they're going to be more likely to have bad reactions and Herxheimer's. They will be able to tolerate the treatment better. So that Herxheimer lipopolysaccharide release, you want to be able to, you're going to be able to deal with that better if you're less tired, if you're sleeping well, if you're eating well, if you're pooping well, and all that stuff. So she treats until the person is symptom-free for 2 months and weans in reverse order. So you're going to, the first thing you're going to wean is from the antimicrobials. So that was a lot. So I think we have to go. So I can talk about more Lyme stuff next week.
Yes, we do.
You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, a talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host, Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, and Spotify. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS stores, and WHUS.org.